Hey guys, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. It's been roughly a week since the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, and the collapse of SVB, or the Silicon Valley Bank, has spurred the collapse of Signature Bank and Silvergate Bank, as well as the downgrading of the outlook for the entire U.S. banking sector. Now it seems the crisis is spreading to Europe, with Credit Suisse shares tumbling earlier this week, sparking concerns that another major financial crisis is set to explode in relatively short order. How did we get here, and what can we expect? Today, we will be exploring the role of the Federal Reserve and the broader situation with cryptocurrencies that played a role in SVB's demise. We'll also be taking a look at the aspects of this case that suggest there's something much bigger at play, such as the role of Palantir co-founder and venture capitalist Peter Thiel in stoking the SVB collapse, and some of the connections shared by the already collapsed and currently most troubled banks, and the tie-ins to major U.S. government overtures regarding cryptocurrency regulation. Joining me today to unpack this complete mess are Marty Bent and Mike Krieger. Marty is the founder of TFTC.io, a media company focused on Bitcoin beauty and freedom in the digital age. He is also a partner at 1031, a leading investment platform focused exclusively on investing in the Bitcoin ecosystem, and he also hosts the Tales from the Crypt, or the TFTC podcast. Mike formerly worked on Wall Street as an oil and gas general commodities analyst and equity research, and later on a trading desk. He left in disgust over the state of the industry and started the website Liberty Blitzkrieg. Though he doesn't blog as much anymore, Mike still shares his insights regularly on social media. So great to have you guys back on. How are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks, Whitney.
Doing well. It's been a crazy week.
Yeah, totally. So the last time you both were here was on episode 43, where we covered the collapse of FTX and all the resulting scandals from that. And since we last spoke, there's been a lot going on in the crypto space. And much of it hasn't been very positive for crypto at all. And some of it, of course, is linked one way to another from the fall to the fallout resulting from FTX. So some of these more recent events I'm referring to here are ultimately part of the story of Silicon Valley Bank's collapse, but preceded that collapse. So I'm talking specifically about some events that caused trouble for the USDC stablecoin, the company that issues that stablecoin, which is Circle, as well as some issues at Silvergate Bank. So let's start there.
I mean, we could start with Silvergate Bank, because I've had some personal experience. I mean, I work at a
Sure. Well, definitely before SVB collapsed, right? There was some stuff going on with Silvergate that was relatively, noteworthy, and seems like it definitely ties in to the events that resulted in SVB's collapse. So why don't we just start with them then?
Yeah, so Silvergate, so in the quote unquote crypto sphere, I focus mainly on Bitcoin, but the overall crypto sphere was banking. A lot of companies were banking with Silvergate. Silvergate was one of the first banks to stick their neck out and say, "Hey, we'll spin up some bank accounts for any companies that are dealing with cryptocurrencies." So a lot of companies in the industry flooded to Silvergate and put a lot of deposits there. One of those companies was FTX, which we discussed in the previous episode. When FTX collapsed, that obviously exposed like a big hole in Silvergate's company, that they had this counterparty, FTX, that people thought had billions of dollars, but it turned out that that money didn't really exist. At the end of the day, they squandered it, and so that set off a contagion event for Silvergate, particularly where a lot of companies in the space started pulling out their deposits and moving it to other banks like Silicon Valley Bank and Signature, which we'll talk about later. But throughout the summer, Silvergate had a run on the bank, and actually, to give Silvergate some credit, they had their bank set up where they had a lot of liquid reserves, so they were able to actually weather a bank run of $8 billion of all these cryptocurrency companies pulling their deposits out of Silvergate and sending it to other banks. But then eventually, the flood became too much about a month ago, three to 4 weeks ago, and Silvergate had to shut down. It was a combination of depositors pulling their money out, and then you had short sellers like Mark Cohodes, and then you had a politician like Elizabeth Warren really beating the drum on social media that Silvergate was insolvent and that people should pull their money out. So essentially everybody pulled their money out. But the interesting thing with Silvergate is they were able to process all the withdrawals from their bank, even after they were officially shut down by the FDIC. So they were actually a very well-capitalized bank.
Yeah, better than a lot of, you know, major other banks that aren't involved in crypto, it seems.
Yeah. As let me just jump in here, too, and add a little bit of additional information. So one, well, my understanding is actually, as Marty was saying, Silvergate was, kind of like hung on impressively for a while, even though it was connected with Alameda and FTX. And obviously the politicians came after it. There's a few other pieces. One is that there was investigations, I think from the DOJ. Certainly there were, sort of a serious criminal investigations, and that was leaked. And so that caused more problems as well. But it seems to, from my understanding, it seems that the final nail in the coffin, interestingly enough, was a prepayment of an FHLB loan. Which was reasonably recently, I think. They actually had, I think, a $4 billion loan from the FHLB. And then they suddenly decided to repay that. And in the process of repaying a $4 billion loan, they had to sell the assets, right? So this is similar to what happened to Silicon Valley Bank. You have all these unrealized losses on their balance sheets, which every bank has. But there was a realized loss was triggered when they prepaid the FHLB loan. And that was the end of it, once they had to realize the losses, and then it just everything accelerated. So that the weird thing about this, and we can tie this into Signature later, because that's a big mystery still for, I've not seen a good explanation for exactly why Signature was effectively nationalized. But Silvergate is weird, too, because it also has one of these sort of nonsensical timelines, which is but the FHLB is claiming that they did not trigger a prepayment, and Silvergate's not saying anything about that. So nobody knows why Silvergate felt the need to actually prepay or pay that loan, which was the final nail in the coffin. So that's another a bit kind weird, of weird thing.
Isn't
very
it?
Weird, very weird. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to bring up something really quick related to this. So Marty, you mentioned Elizabeth Warren. So I think thanks to her and some of this other investigations from the government that were related to the fallout from FTX, because of the FTX having accounts at Silvergate, they were targeting Silvergate. But, as other people, including myself and Ed Berger, have reported, there was this very suspect bank that's very small in Washington State called Farmington State Bank that had recently rebranded as Moonstone Bank. And FTX had a lot of suspect, specifically Alameda had a lot of suspect activity there. And that hasn't been scrutinized at all, right? So that kind of suggests that there was a particular interest in scrutinizing Silvergate relative to other US-based institutions that were tied up with FTX. And it's interesting when you look at what's happened since, what we're specifically talking about here now with Silvergate, how, with Signature gone and Silvergate gone, and that doesn't really leave very many pro-crypto, quote-unquote, banks in the U.S. anymore, because as I understand it, the only other bank in that sphere until relatively recently was like Metropolitan Bank or something, and they announced that they were going to get into their work with crypto earlier this year because of regulatory pressure from the SEC, so...
Yeah. So let me put this out there now, and we'll get into it more later. But this is one of the things that I didn't recognize at first. But the more I read into it, the more it becomes clear why Silvergate and Signature in particular is so important here. For one thing, when people sort of read about this in the mainstream, media or just anywhere really, what you keep hearing is like Signature and Silvergate were crypto banks, right? They were the main crypto banks. And it's true that a lot of the companies would hold their cash there, like let's say Coinbase, Circle. I think Circle was also at Silicon Valley Bank, but a lot of the industry would have their bank accounts there. But I actually, crypto companies, Bitcoin companies, there are banking relationships with large banks, right? The mega banks. So it's not like they're not involved. I think what separates Silvergate and Signature and why they were targeted actually have to do with the SEN network. It's Silvergate and Signet at Signature. So SEN is the Silvergate Exchange Network. And these two things were crucial to the functioning of a like 24/7 fiat to stablecoin market. Because as you know, like if you've ever used a US bank or any bank, if you want to try to do something over the weekend, good luck. You know, how are you going to send a wire? How are you going to send, you know, dollars from one place to another using the banking institutions are closed, right? It's outside of hours. But the crypto ecosystem operates 24/7. And so if you're running stable coins and you know you need that liquidity from USD fiat into the stable coin for that market to function 24/7, you need a 24/7 capacity to make those things happen. And so that's what Silvergate was doing with SEN. And therefore, I think that is clearly why they were targeted. And Signature was also doing a similar thing. And so this to me, it was the main reason, because if you think about it, a USD stable coin that's able to function all the time and effectively, if it could do it, if it can effectively be sort of seen as a 24/7 USD instrument, that's kind of a CBDC, but being run privately. And so if you're going to actually try to roll out a CBDC run by the Fed, you can't have a functioning, competitor, you could say, right? That's not in their control.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because for those that don't know, the Federal Reserve is trying to launch its own round-the-clock payment and settlement service, which is called FedNow, right? So maybe they, this seems like kind of a convenient way to maybe get rid of some of the competition to pave the way for CBDCs, which seems to be sort of a bigger theme, out of this whole discussion about how CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, tie into everything. But yeah, it's definitely very convenient then that these networks have, critical networks of crypto infrastructure have essentially been decimated, right? Or at least they'll be bought up by some big Wall Street bank.
Right. Because think about it. If you're already kind of sending USD via a stablecoin that's like considered legit all the time around the world, whenever you want, then what do you need a CBDC for? I mean, that's sort of the
exactly.
I think that's why this was all done, and that's also why they're saying the FDIC is now saying that whoever buys Signature's assets or the bank itself has to get rid of the crypto part. That's completely weird and arbitrary, unless that's the whole point.
Well, as we'll talk about later, there's some people arguing that the shutdown of Signature Bank itself was arbitrary. So there's a lot of weird stuff going on with that bank in particular. So before we move on to the next thing, anything you'd like to add, Marty, to the discussion about SEN and some of these payment networks?
I mean, they were very crucial for the industry. So SEN was Silvergate's, and then Signatures was Signet. And essentially, I mean, Bitcoin trades 24/7, 365. So obviously people are buying Bitcoin on the weekends if the price is moving, or if they simply just want to buy Bitcoin on a whim. And so these exchanges and companies being able to send money between each other over the weekend was a crucial function that Silvergate and Signature provided the industry. And obviously, yes, stablecoins were using it too. But even for Bitcoin exchanges that need to move funds between each other, it was a big value add as well. So this being taken out certainly hurt the industry too. To a large extent.
All right. Well, let's move on to talking about how the SVB collapse may have been influenced by the Federal Reserve, and more specifically, some of the Fed's monetary policy during COVID. So there were apparently some not so great bets made by SVB during the COVID-19 crisis and all of that. And then there's the issue about the Fed's recent efforts to combat inflation and tightening and all of that. So what are your guys' thoughts about the role the Federal Reserve played, if any, in what we're seeing or what we've seen over the past couple weeks?
Yeah, I think the Fed's policy over the last 3.5 years is the main driver of this systemic banking contagion that seems to be playing out, not only here in the United States, but also in Europe. So during COVID, March 2020, when the global economy shut down, the Fed drove interest rates down to zero and printed trillions of dollars and kept interest rates low and kept printing for about a year and a half. And then essentially what happened is you had all these banks load up their capital reserves with particular instruments. In Silicon Valley Bank's case, they bought a lot of mortgage-backed securities, which were the crux of the banking crisis of 2008. Essentially, when Silicon Valley Bank bought these mortgage-backed securities, put them on their balance sheet, they did that with the assumption that the Fed was likely to keep interest rates low for an extended period of time. And so essentially what happened is when the Fed started raising rates last year and pulling dollars out of the system, Silicon Valley Bank found itself in a very vulnerable position where they had a what's called a duration mismatch. They had a lot of these MBSs on their book, which are longer dated. And as the Fed began pulling dollars out of the system and Silicon Valley Bank's customers began withdrawing funds, it really affected that portion of their balance sheet. And so when the Fed raises rates, the price of the underlying bonds or debt instruments has an inverse correlation. So the Fed raises rates very fast, very rapidly, and pulls dollars out of the system. The debt instruments, the price of those instruments typically falls as rates go up. And so what we found was Silicon Valley Bank had these MBSs on their balance sheet and they were losing value over time. And so it was essentially just a ticking time bomb. As the Fed has kept raising rates and kept pulling dollars out of the system, the value of that capital on their balance sheet was decreasing. And this is happening to every bank, not just Silicon Valley Bank. And it's not just mortgage-backed securities, it's treasuries as well. So a lot of banks, instead of buying mortgage-backed securities, are buying treasuries and find themselves in the same situation. So essentially what happened last week is the bomb went off. The value of the reserves in their balance sheet fell to such a point that as people began withdrawing cash from Silicon Valley Bank, probably stemming from fears of Silvergate going down and their customers wanting to diversify a bit, they were forced to sell their mortgage-backed securities and realize losses as well. And then that created a cascading event where they were selling these instruments, and just the act of selling was driving the price down even further. And as people were withdrawing money, the value of that part of their balance sheet basically collapsed. And then on top of that, it was really hard to sell. Mortgage-backed securities are a bit more illiquid than something like treasuries. And so you had a run on that bank, and that was exacerbated by the VC industry in that part of the country, basically going to their portfolio companies, Peter Thiel, most notably from Founders Fund, emailing the portfolio companies and urging them to take their money out of Silicon Valley Bank last week. And that word got out and created a massive run on the bank, and it went under within 48 hours.
Yeah. And, you know, let me just sort of add a different perspective here, too. So anyone that's been in the financial industry or watches markets or anything like that will know that there's, you know, sort of an understanding that when the Fed embarks on a aggressive interest rate hike cycle, that they break something, right? And they usually break something big. And that's sort of like the joke. So, you know, when the Fed starts raising and keeps raising, every sort of market participant is just sitting there waiting for like the dead bodies to start rising to the surface, because it always happens, right? In this case in particular, you really knew it was going to happen, because the cycle of the lowest interest rates and QE in history was so extended. I mean, it was really about a decade, that so much craziness, right? So much insane behavior, one of which would be, you know, buying, bonds at the, or let's say even treasury bonds at the highest price in a 40-year 40-year bull market, with leverage potentially in some cases. So there's a lot of bodies to float to the surface when the Fed raises rates this high. And I think everyone needs to remember what happened back in 2008 and 2009. You know, it wasn't just the, you know, the crisis and the bailouts. There was a huge power consolidation that happened afterwards, because when the Fed creates a scenario where people or the system itself is struggling and on the verge of failure, the Fed and the government can then step in and play favorites, you know, and say, okay, well, you can die and you can live and you can get trillions and then you can buy everything up, right? And that's exactly what happened after 2008. I mean, what happened after 2008? The Fed became much more powerful. I mean, effectively, the Fed can do anything at this point. I don't think there's anything the Fed couldn't do if the crisis was scary enough at this point, you know, and they would just be able to mm-hmm. do it. And Congress would just say, please, please save us, right? You know, kind of during COVID, they were doing crazy things there too, right? Even more crazy. Right. So that's the world we're in now. And that was because of 2008. Prior to that, this was not the case, you know. And so I remember very clearly back then there was so much uproar over things that now that people just assume is part of regular Fed duties that was completely unprecedented back then. So the amount of power that the Fed consolidated post 2008 was massive. The amount of power that the big banks consolidated was massive and is massive. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, with the housing market, things happened in the housing market post 2008 that really changed the fundamentals of how the housing market worked. For example, And I went really, I mean, this was a period of my life where I was just so enraged about what I was seeing. That's now normal stuff, right? So, you know, Americans were getting kicked out of their homes left and right, as everyone remembers, mm-hmm. right? They were foreclosed on. Nobody was saving them, right? They were just getting kicked to the curb, losing their homes because, oh, they were, you know, they were reckless, right? Like, as if they were the ones that created the systemic problems. And then guess what happened 2 years later? You had Blackstone in particular, but others as well, using the extraordinarily cheap financing that the Fed was pumping out there and they had access to through a subsidiary called Invitation Homes. And they were buying up all of the houses that Americans got kicked out of and then renting it back to them. So mm-hmm. I want to make sure that everyone understands here that when the Fed breaks stuff in a big way, which they're in the process of doing, that is always an opportunity for power consolidation. And that's exactly what I think is going to happen, or at least going to be attempted.
Yeah, a friend of mine actually sent me a graphic that he'd seen on Twitter that was pretty a really good graphical representation of how much the banks, the big Wall Street banks, have consolidated themselves in the past few decades. I mean, we'll put it in the show notes. It's pretty crazy to look at because it's, you know, what started off, you know, 20 years ago is like 10 banks is like 3 banks now. And when you have this kind of stuff, like you're talking about and what we're seeing right now, it's pretty much inevitable that one of these bigger banks are going to be the ones that buy up a lot of what's left of SVB or Signature. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously a consolidation, I think, is definitely in the works. And that just tends to be what happens during any financial crisis. You know, wealth goes up and the people on the bottom get screwed over and over again. So it doesn't really seem like things happening now are any different than they've been in the past. But
no. And the really pernicious thing is that the Fed really breaks things in both directions with their monetary policy. So when they were lowering rates and printing money post COVID lockdowns, like they basically broke supply chains and pricing mechanisms of the world. That's why inflation flew in 2021 and 2022. And so like not only do they break things when they raise rates really aggressively, but it's true for what they're doing policy decisions in the other direction when they're lowering rates. Like the Fed is really a pernicious actor throughout our economy that is either really screwing you by adding fuel to the inflation fire, or conversely the other way, just creating a liquidity crisis that leads to all this consolidation that you just described.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're at over 100 years of the Fed, so I think it's pretty fair to say the data is in and it doesn't work. Make it go away.
Yeah. And also, you know, one of the things I was writing about when I was writing more frequently was this concept of financial feudalism. And, you know, for example, during that period of time, this is one example of many, but during the period of time when we had the 0% rates, and, you know, especially large financial institutions and people that have access to capital markets or the Fed could essentially borrow at nothing. You know, what was your credit card rate? You know, was it zero? You know, what was it? 2? Was it 3? Was it 4? Was it 5%? No, it was, you know, 19%. You know, and so, you know, there's this, again, it's important to understand that within that system of the Fed, you know, making things too easy, pumping liquidity, and then breaking things, a key component to the power consolidation and wealth consolidation is the fact that there are people and entities that are favored, right, throughout, systemically favored, and then everyone else who does not have the ability to access and leverage those low rates. In fact, I think I discussed this on a pod with Marty once, but the only way the average person or you know, a normie has had the ability to essentially leverage in a big way, like the banks do and the hedge funds do, is buying homes, actually. That's always been the one way, because when you buy a home and you take a big mortgage, that's what you're doing. So that, other than that, though, I mean, the average person, you know, is paying high rates. They're not borrowing at zero and just like buying up assets.
All right. Well, how about we move on then to the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank itself and how that sort of played out, and then take a look at Signature Bank, since we haven't really talked about them too much yet. So as most people probably know by now, at least people that have looked into this, a lot, at least the official narrative thus far, is that a lot of what happened with Silicon Valley Bank was allegedly triggered by a threat of a downgrade by the credit rating agency Moody's, and then Goldman Sachs steps in. So I guess we'll go from there to talk about some of the stuff that led to the collapse of this bank.
Yeah, I mean, sure. So I'll start there. From my understanding of the timeline, and this is interesting too, and sort of plays into what we've been discussing, but what really got it going was a Moody's call to, I believe, Silicon Valley Bank executives saying, you know, you're on our, you know, you're about to be downgraded, essentially. And if you remember, again, the 2008-2009 period, you'll recall that the ratings agencies played a huge role in saying that all these junk mortgage securities were AAA. And of course they were worthless, right? And so the rating agencies are still around and they're still, you know, doing things sort of in a crony or arbitrary way. But in any event, with that call, Silicon Valley Bank then realized that they needed to do something. And part of doing something there was trying to shore up their capital. And so that's when they began trying to raise money and also sell assets. And again, back to what happened with Silvergate, when they decided to prepay the FHLB loan. This is when Silicon Valley Bank started realizing losses. And when you realize losses, then, you know, you have to then take action. More action. So it's a sort of like this downward spiral. Once you realize a loss, then you're going to have more problems. You have to raise money, and then nobody wants to give you money. And then you had the bank run thing. But the really interesting thing there is the role that Peter Thiel seemed to play in that, in the sense that once he came out, or once it became public that he was telling all, you know, the Founders Fund to pull all of their money from SVB, that was it. I mean, that was the end of the bank. And so by effectively doing that, Silicon Valley Bank was murdered, you know. And so that's the timeline as I understand it. And yeah, it's bizarre, you know. And again, look, Moody's could do that to anyone, and that's the scary thing. You know, Moody's can sort of go, but would they do it to J.P. Morgan? You know what I mean? Like, would they dare do it to J.P. Morgan? Probably not. But they're going around now looking at other regional banks. You sent that article about that. I think they're looking at like Zion Bank and a bunch of others.
Yeah, Comerica. Right. There's a few. Yeah. I think it's 6 in total. First Republic is another one.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so the moment you do that, you're sparking something. So, you know, what role is Moody's playing in this? You know, to what extent is it intentional? Is it not? You know, again, though, I go back to the fact that, you know, would it be allowed even if, let's say, one of the biggest, like a JP Morgan or something, what if they had similar issues? Would Moody's be allowed politically to actually make that phone call or that downgrade? You know, if not, that's exactly how you consolidate everything.
Yeah, and literally as we're talking right now, First Republic, which you just mentioned, their shares were halted. They were limited down as soon as the market opened today. So it seems like Moody's is taking that back under as we speak.
Uh-oh.
Right. So again, I mean, it's to get, this is what I think people need to understand. It's like to get the ball rolling on a total bank run is not that difficult. And so it feels to me as if it's being allowed, you know, it's sort of being encouraged perhaps even, you know, on these non quote systemically important banks, right? The too big to fails, you know. Yeah. And so
I was just going to say, and that's, I mean, we've really seen this again, being somewhat close to companies that they're scrambling for bank accounts in the wake of all these bank runs and failures. JP Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo are benefiting massively. People are flooding to those banks to open accounts and move their deposits there as quickly as possible.
Right, exactly. Because as of what we said, which is that they're too big to fail and essentially in bed with the state completely. I mean, they're just the same thing effectively. And so I looked at the article you sent, Whitney, and yeah, so that was in the title, First Republic. Moody's puts First Republic and five U.S. banks on downgrade watch, Western Alliance of America. Yeah. So, I mean, there you go. this is how you, if they were thinking about doing this to J.P. Morgan, you'd probably get a phone call. Moody's would get a phone call and they'd be told, don't do it. So they're clearly, I think, probably being encouraged to do this. You know, and then for what ends?
Yes, second bank on that list, Western Alliance, their trades were just halted as well for volatility. So it seems like they're going under.
Yeah, it's ongoing. It's ongoing. It seems like a snowball that's intentionally being allowed to happen.
So let's talk about, you mentioned Peter Thiel a little bit ago. So let's talk about him and his role, because you even have mainstream media, at least financial journalists, sort of talking about his role. So you have Dave Troy, a mainstream media investigative journalist, I think. He said something like, SVB did not properly hedge its risk against two threats, the first of those risks being concentration of influence by Peter Thiel. So is he, I guess, referring to the influence of Thiel on startups that were banking at SVB specifically?
I think that is certainly the case, but I would also add, just not on the individual companies within Founders Fund's portfolio, but just in the Valley more generally. I think people in the venture space look at Peter Thiel and put him on a pedestal. And if he's doing something, they're a bunch of sheep who move with the crowd. So if Peter signals something, they're probably going to follow him. So it's not just Founders Fund's portfolio companies, but just the Valley more generally as well.
Right. Okay. So what's interesting to me about this, you have some companies, like one of the fintech startup called Brex that's backed by Thiel and another PayPal guy, was able to get billions of dollars out of Silicon Valley Bank the day before it collapsed. Yeah. Which is kind of, I guess, spurred by Thiel telling people to get their money out to an extent. But it's interesting to me just because Brex is tied up with other people around sort of this PayPal sphere. Sometimes people call it the PayPal mafia. So in that particular company, Brex, it's backed by Thiel and another, I think PayPal, not co-founder, but one of the early CEOs when Thiel and Musk were both there. And then you have that particular company, Brex, teaming up with OpenAI, which is ChatGPT's parent company. To create advanced AI-powered tools for CFOs and their teams. So basically turning ChatGPT into, you know, something that can be used to probably get rid of a lot of jobs in the finance sector, because, you know, Well, I've been talking about in some of my recent work how ChatGPT is poised to, you know, they're talking about how it's passing bar exams. It can replace lawyers. It'll replace mainstream media journalists. So interesting to see some of those connections there. And also Musk himself was talking about who, by the way, has a Musk has a stake, I think, or helped co-found OpenAI, ChatGPT's parent company, and is part of the same PayPal nexus. He was going to said he was open to the idea of buying Silicon Valley Bank to turn Twitter into a digital bank. Kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah, that was a strange comment. He also made a comment though yesterday, I think it was, about ChatGPT. Did you all see that? That was kind of strange because someone was saying, you know, OpenAI went from being open to not open, and it went from being a nonprofit to like apparently very interested in profits. And Musk said something about that. He was like, "Oh well, how I gave $100 million to a nonprofit, and now all of a sudden it's not, you know, not a nonprofit. Like, what happened there? Is that legal?" So yeah. Right. So, yeah, Marty, do you want to add anything there? Because I don't really have too much to say on that.
No, yeah, I was like, OpenAI is like a really weird story. Because, like you mentioned, it started as a nonprofit. I think Elon pumped a bunch of cash into it because he was really afraid of AI and said, "All right, if we're going to go after AI, we want it to be in a nonprofit way." So it's more open source to an extent. But Sam Altman, who is the CEO of OpenAI, I think at one point he realized the potential profits that can be driven from this technology and decided, you know what, we're not going to be a nonprofit anymore. We're going to make this a profit-driven business. From what I understand, it's irked Elon a bit. But one interesting thing to know with OpenAI and its founder, Sam Altman, he's also the founder of WorldCoin, which is an attempt to create like a CBDC-like global digital currency.
Weren't they the guys scanning people's faces or irises for money?
They're still doing it. They're attacking. They are attacking. I would use the word attacking. They're down in Africa scanning people's irises and onloading them onto their wallet right now.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, yeah. I didn't even know that was still going on. That's scary. I'll have to look into that. But
yeah,
I think the marketing ploy was that if you scan your iris, they'll give you some free WorldCoin or something.
Yeah.
Can you imagine how little they think of people, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, ChatGPT, I mean, they pretty much have a bunch of people thinking they're playing with some cool toy, but they're basically training this AI algorithm to take all their jobs away. And now they've released this big upgrade of it because, you know, millions of users training this algorithm for them for free. And then they can license it or team up with companies like this teal-backed Brex company, right? And then use all that data that people are freely giving them to come in and do a whole bunch of, you know, stuff that's automating more and more jobs. Yeah, so I have a lot to say about ChatGPT, but I don't want to get too off topic. So to go back to Peter Thiel for a second. So you guys, I'm sure, remember that a couple years ago, Peter Thiel made a really unusual comment about Bitcoin and crypto. He on a panel with Mike Pompeo, who was either Secretary of State or CIA director at the time. I can't remember. Which one? He essentially said that, you know, even though he prefaced this statement by saying that he was pro-crypto and a Bitcoin maximalist, he claimed that Bitcoin may also be a Chinese financial weapon. And this is interesting in the context of what we talked about a little bit ago, like people like Elizabeth Warren, for example, and a lot of other prominent Democrats and also Republicans as well are making the claim that cryptocurrency and specifically Bitcoin are national security threats.
Yeah. So that was I remember when that happened and I went kind of a little crazy on Twitter because it was so infuriating to me to see him say that. Yeah, that was like spring of 2021. You know, let me just kind of dissect that a little bit. Now, Peter Thiel, for all of his what we may not like about him, is a very intelligent individual, right? He's not stupid, right? He's
smart. Sure, yeah.
Right. And so he knows exactly what his words mean, and he knows what he's saying. It's not difficult. Now, if you're going to come out there and say that Bitcoin could be a Chinese weapon against the United States while you're standing next to Mike Pompeo, that is a very destructive narrative
totally
putting out there. Yeah. And so he knows that. There's no way he doesn't know that. And so he's sort of seeding that narrative. And that is a pure, you know, national security, deep state talking point, period. And he's also a guy who, you know, if he claims to believe in freedom, you know, to spin Bitcoin in such a way when he knows full well that China has not been encouraging to Bitcoin, you know, has been in many steps of the way.
Cracking down on it.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like China has been, yeah, let's really advance the cause of Bitcoin. It's been quite the opposite, in fact. So for him to say that, it's just completely dishonest. So that's a red flag right there. And also, if you actually believe in freedom, you know, as Marty has basically dedicated his life to linking Bitcoin with freedom and American values, which I completely agree with that view, to denigrate Bitcoin in this sort of a way, when he clearly understands that it does embody in so many ways the ethos of the Republic of the United States, is a huge red flag. And so, you know, for me, I feel like Peter Thiel is always talking out of both sides of his mouth. I feel like he, whether he's doing it on purpose or not is unknown. But I will say that he's too often completely contradicting himself, and he portrays himself in one way, but then says things that are completely antithetical to what he's saying. So a very strange character for sure. Obviously, I know Whitney has done a lot of work on him, and of course Palantir and all that stuff, and his ties to the national security state. But yeah, this was a weird comment, and I'll never forget it. You know, unless he clears that up, I mean, that was a very concerning and, in my opinion, huge red flag and destructive narrative to be seeding out there, which is also completely false.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because he made that statement, and a year later, he's at the Bitcoin Magazine conference talking about how great Bitcoin is after calling it a year before like a Chinese financial weapon. And he definitely is a contradictory guy. So I think he definitely wants to posture a lot to the pro-freedom crowd. So, you know, he'll portray himself, for example, as a Bitcoin maxi and then go and call it a Chinese financial weapon. He'll call himself a libertarian. And he's only built the most like damaging software for freedom in the hands of every single U.S. intelligence agency that's used to profile, you know, thought crime and is an integral part of this war on domestic terror. And you even had people saying on websites like Seeking Alpha that Peter Thiel should use Palantir to rein in Bitcoin after he made these comments. And that is not someone who is libertarian at all. But, you know, he likes to posture as that for whatever reason.
Yeah,
and I think it's a calculated PR move, not unlike Elon Musk trying to cater to a very specific audience, you know, through what he puts out publicly, his tweets, his memes, and all of that, while at the same time, it seems like his actions, a lot of time he's playing a different game, you know?
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, it definitely, Peter Thiel definitely seems like a person who's saying he's one thing, and then every action he takes seems to not confirm anything he says about himself. Very bizarre guy.
Yeah, it's very perplexing. It's like, he's one of the hardest people to read from my perspective, because like, is he trying to take a superposition where he'll talk out of both sides of his mouth and put money in both directions, pro freedom with Bitcoin and pro dystopian hellscape with companies like Palantir? I don't know if he's...
And also the companies he backs through Founders Fund, like Anduril, which is run by Palmer Luckey, the guy that made Oculus Rift. Left Facebook, created Anduril, which is a startup basically for U.S. national security, and it's all about creating basically a surveillance apparatus on the U.S.-Mexican border, ostensibly to stop illegal immigration, but it will also keep people from going from the U.S. to Mexico, not just keep people from going to Mexico to the U.S., right? And it's all surveillance drones, weaponized drones, and these, you know, surveillance tower. I mean, it's basically the Sauron tower. And, you know, these guys love their, like, Lord of the Ring, you know, references and all that stuff. But it's, I don't know. He's also put a lot of money in companies like Carbine 911, which is all tied up with the Epstein network. I've talked about them before. And they're basically steadily taking over the entire United States 911 emergency services call system. right now. And part of that is actually thanks to legislation put through by Congress last year. So anyway, I'll be circling back to that at some point, hopefully soon. But there's a, you know, Founders Fund is invested in all sorts of Orwellian hellish stuff. So I don't know. It's really hard for me to see these guys as pro-freedom.
Whitney, I just one last thing I would add, like something that I've thought about a little bit is, you know, if they're going to roll, if a big attempt to roll out a CBDC is coming, which I think we all believe is, you know, how useful would it be to have the big players in Silicon Valley and banking to effectively rally around it? And so I wonder if part of what's going on here with Silicon Valley Bank is now the Valley feels indebted in some way, perhaps to the state, and maybe more likely to be amenable or participatory in, you know, some sort of panopticon digital currency. I'm guessing that the first step along the way to a CBDC will be somehow, and I'm not sure exactly how, but somehow promoted as a public-private partnership, right?
Like, I was just going to say that. Yeah, I think there's going to be some sort of public-private pre-CBDC potentially rolled out alongside it, maybe following sort of like that the Spur coin model in Russia through Sberbank, Russia's largest bank. It's run by Herman Graf, who's all tied up with the World Economic Forum. But it's technically not a CBDC, right? But it's already widely in use, and it's basically a public-private thing. Yeah.
A public-private CBDC is the only way they can do it. There's no way the government could actually like write the software that produces a CBDC. They couldn't even produce a website for healthcare.gov that actually works. They're going to need the tech firms to build it for them.
Right. And so is this related to Silicon Valley Bank in some way? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's one of these weird things where we kind of have to see how it plays out. But I do think, and this is why I really wanted to come on and be part of this, is that we need to be talking about it now, because the reason the COVID PSYOP was so effective, you know, and it PSYOPed me for a few months completely. And I'm pretty ashamed of that, but I vowed to learn my lesson, was that it was just so much at once out of nowhere that something I personally wasn't really thinking about. And so, we need to be talking about this stuff ahead of time, even though we don't know exactly what they're up to.
Yeah, totally. Well, on that note, really quick, if there's some sort of public-private partnership, right, it may not necessarily have to be overtly one, because we got to keep in mind, too, if you're talking about Silicon Valley specifically, and specifically the big five tech companies, almost, I'm pretty sure all of them at this point are U.S. government contractors, specifically military and or intelligence contractors. I mean, there's several that are both. So, you know, they could easily be pulled in to build the infrastructure, and it could still be essentially framed as, you know, an entirely public sector project, right? So,
yeah, I think the way it's going to play out is, this banking crisis is going to continue to go on. Banks are going to fail, and they're going to hit a head where they say, all right, the banks don't work anymore. We're nationalizing them. The Fed is going to control all the deposits, and here's your CBDC wallet. One of the tech firms helped us build it, download it.
Right. This
is how you access your money now.
Well, before we get there, let's go back and talk about a couple of things that have already happened before we get to the point of discussing where things stand now and how things are likely to play out from here on out. So we haven't quite talked about Signature Bank yet, but we've alluded to it. And there's been claims that its shutdown was completely arbitrary. This is coming from crypto venture capitalist Nick Carter on Twitter, but there's other people that have made this claim. And Carter's claims specifically come from Barney Frank, who is the guy from the Frank Dodd, you know, banking act stuff post-2008. And he was apparently added to Signature Bank's board, I believe, in 2015. And he essentially said that Signature Bank didn't really have to be shut down when it was shut down. So the question is, why was it shut down? What's the timeline here? What doesn't make sense? And what's really going on? So whoever wants to start unpacking that, go right ahead.
It was really weird because Signature was shut down on a Sunday, last Sunday, after Silicon Valley Bank went down. So the fact that it was closed on a weekend, it didn't even have the potential to open up on Monday and begin servicing withdrawals, if that is what was happening, was a bit odd. And another thing with the shutdown is that it was a bit different than Silicon Valley Bank, where the FDIC came in and said, all right, we're taking over. On Sunday, the New York Department of Financial Services stepped in and said, Signature, you're shutting down before market open on Monday. And as Barney Frank mentioned earlier this week, he was pretty confident that the bank was liquid enough to service withdrawals. So it was a bit odd that the NYDFS stepped in and shut them down out of nowhere.
Yeah, and it was interesting too. So when I was first trying to research what happened, I was just looking up Signature Bank, right, and trying to read as much as I could about any article about it. And it was really bizarre because every article was saying the same thing, which was nothing. You know, they were just like, New York Department of Financial Services decided to shut down Signature Bank. That's it. You know, there was no timeline. There was no rationale. And so the only thing that sticks out here is Signet. Again, back to Silvergate, I remember, as we discussed earlier, had the SEN network, which was crucial to providing liquidity and the ability to get in and out of exchanges and fiat to stablecoins and all that stuff. And so the other one was Signet. And so it appears to me clearly that the intention with getting rid of Signature was to get rid of Signet as well, and then make that sort of ecosystem struggle. Now, again, like New York Department of Financial Services, as Marty mentioned, like New York is just, of course, the most dirty place when it comes to stuff like this, it's the, you know, it's the womb of the too big to fails, right? It's the womb of like Wall Street. And so, you know, that state, that city is going to protect that at all costs. And so that was, you know, that's strange in itself. But I think, yeah, and the fact, as I mentioned earlier, that they're now saying, the FDIC apparently is saying, that anyone who buys Signature has to close down the crypto activities. Well, why? You know, like what is going on here? So yeah, it makes no sense. I mean, the Signature, I'm open to other ideas here, but I didn't even see anything about asset sales. So for example, as we discussed earlier, Silicon Valley Bank and Silvergate were both triggered into selling assets, which created realized losses for a variety of reasons. I haven't read that about Signature. Perhaps they did, but I didn't read that. And so again, I'm waiting for someone to explain to me what exactly triggered Signature Bank. What made it different? There's, at the end of the day, it's impossible that the two banks that ran these networks, SEN and Signet, just are the two of the three that ended up dead.
Yeah, and from like the asset side of things for Signature particularly, you'd think if they have one of the two senators who wrote the bill that defined the type of capital requirements for these banks was sitting on the board, he'd actually be very astute to making sure that the bank that he was associated with was capitalized the correct way. So yeah, it was all very, very weird how it happened. The fact that it happened on a Sunday, sort of out of nowhere, very odd.
Well, here's one possibility. I think maybe, well, so the bailout of Silicon Valley Bank, which I want to talk about next, I think the way they got around the loophole they used to offer that bailout was about systemic risk, right? So in order to argue for systemic risk, they'd have to be like, well, systemic means other banks are in danger of failing. So I don't know, that could have been sort of the claim that, oh, we think Signature Bank's going to be the next to fail, and this is part of our response tied up with the SVB bailout. I mean, maybe I'm wrong on that, but
yeah. But think about what you just said, right? I mean, even if they said that, that's just crazy, right? I mean, that's
no,
like,
but it's the public justification. You know what I mean? Yeah, but it's the public justification, right? Yeah. And in this space, there's a lot of preemptive stuff going on. Like I just did a video the other day about the WEF partnership against cybercrime, and they're talking about, you know, going after Bitcoin because of ransomware and all this stuff, and that they need to preemptively go after networks that might engage in some sort of cyber financial cyber crime. You know, I mean, they love preemptive stuff, whether it's financial stuff or the war on domestic terrorism or whatever. I mean, pre-crime is quickly becoming a major facet of United States government policy. So,
well, think about it, too, that with Signature, if they had waited 24 hours, probably there'd be no even rationale to do anything because you had all these facilities in, right? So it's like they were like, let's kill this and then, you know, announce a huge bailout, right? That was weird, too.
Yeah. It's contradictory in many ways, like, because they wound up bailing out Silicon Valley Bank depositors. And if they really were worried about contagion risk, like, why would they shut down Signature Bank? That just signals that banks of a similar profile are at similar risk. And so you would have a run on those banks as well. Like, so if they really wanted to stem contagion, they would have every incentive to make it seem like Signature is very well capitalized. They would try their hardest to keep it open.
But maybe if they wanted to close it right to target Signet, exactly. They're like, well, we can wrap this up as part of this collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and make it look like our shuttering of this is linked to that.
Right. Yeah, that's what they did. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's the other thing, too, about how Signature Bank was facing some major criminal probes, apparently, before it was shuttered.
I saw that. I mean, I guess you could just say, again, you know, if you want to kill a bank, all you have to do is say, hey, we're looking into you. Right. I mean, and I think they do this to people, just citizens sometimes too these days, you know, where they can just destroy you.
Yeah. But they did this, like we just talked about, to Silvergate as well.
Right,
like, oh, exactly. We're going to target you because of FTX and Signature as, oh, we're going to target you because we think people are using your crypto business or your exposure to crypto to for money laundering schemes.
Right. Which at the end of the day, it seems like they were just looking for an excuse to get rid of these two networks, you know, for a variety of reasons.
Yeah, I think that's true, because every time, like, you know, the feds come in and accuse someone of money laundering, I mean, it's kind of silly because the national security state launders a ton of money and the big banks launder tons of money for drug cartels and whatever. And people like Catherine Austin Fitz have pointed out that if, you know, the drug trade stopped tomorrow, a lot of these big banks would collapse because they're dependent on, you know, the money laundering of a lot of those illicit funds, whether for, you know, cartels or intelligence agencies or whatever. Like, when they actually decide to prosecute these kinds of financial crimes, there's usually, not always, but, you know, sometimes there's an ulterior motive. And I think that's quite probable here, especially when you consider that some of this legislation in the works, like Elizabeth Warren's legislation that argues that crypto is a national security threat. It's about financing terrorism and money laundering are part of the justifications for that, right? But it's not like getting rid of crypto is going to stop money laundering. Money laundering, of course, preceded crypto's existence by many decades. So it's not like it'll go away even if crypto magically disappears, right?
No, in the overarching narrative battle, I think that's something really important that we have to dig into and really seed in the minds of the masses, is that the biggest perpetrators of money laundering and criminal activity are the big banks and the governments. It's not people using Bitcoin.
Yeah, this goes back. And this also goes back to the whole thing where, you know, we're not allowed to have privacy, but they need to have ultimate privacy. You know, we're not allowed to do anything, but they can do everything in the shadows. And so, yeah, I mean, so if everybody's sort of transactions are known and tracked, then whoever is in power can say, oh, It's sort of a good blackmail thing too, because you can just, you know what everyone's doing, and then you can go up to someone and say, hey, by the way, you know, did you do this 2 years ago and blah blah blah, and then okay, well, you can either play with us or you can go to jail, you know. And so it's like this,
this idea of financial blackmail has been going on for a long time. In my book and in volume one, I actually wrote about how Armand Hammer, the guy that ran Occidental Petroleum, was trying to acquire a major U.S. bank because so many congressmen had open accounts there for the purposes explicitly of what he called financial blackmail.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, you know, if there were people thinking about doing this in the early 80s, you know, I'm sure it's happened by now, right? So
yeah, I think the only positive thing I guess I could say about it is, like, what they seem to think they can do is take all of these things that have been going on effectively since the beginning of time, right? I mean, sexual blackmail, financial blackmail, all that stuff is, you could probably find instances of that in every culture that's beyond, you know, or city that's beyond a few thousand people, because it's just what humans kind of do. But, or psycho humans do. But what they seem to be, think they can do is just like completely own it, you know, just have it on a level that is so institutionalized and dominant that it encompasses everything. And there's no sort of black market or wiggle room or freedom. And I guess to me, it's such a brazen goal that I sort of think it's doomed to fail. But yeah, it's certainly what they want. I mean, they're going just for everything.
Well, before we leave Signature, I just wanted to say that there's a new report out today that claims, it cites the New York financial regulator that shut it down. Their rationale for shutting down Signature Bank, they have now said it was, quote, a significant crisis of confidence in the bank's leadership, end quote.
Yeah, it means nothing. That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I know.
Right. They could say that.
The leadership wasn't going to get rid of their crypto business. So we're going to shut you down, and whoever buys the bank has to give up all the crypto business.
Exactly. It's just like, we don't like you. Right? We don't like the CEO. Bye.
Yeah. If you didn't think that the government is organized crime, especially in New York State, I would urge you to reconsider.
It's wild.
It's crazy.
It's egregious. Yeah. It's disgusting.
Well, what will come of it? Let's see. Well, how about we talk about the bailout then? So what has the Biden administration said about the Silicon Valley Bank bailout? How has that changed the situation? And how are taxpayers on the hook, even though the Biden administration says they're not? And what can we expect regarding inflation?
So, diving into the actual mechanics of the bailout, I think what the Treasury, in conjunction with the Federal Reserve and the FDIC, said was essentially, hey, we will buy your debt instruments at par value. So as we mentioned earlier, a lot of what caused this contagion event in the banking sector was that the Fed raised rates and drove down the value of the debt instruments that are holding on the books. And they're still, if marked to market, they would be significantly depressed. And so the bailout is essentially the Fed stepping in and saying, hey, even though these bonds are worth 85 cents on the dollar, we'll buy them at a dollar from you and we'll hold them on our books. And at some point in the future, you can buy them back in full when the markets settle and the banking system becomes more stable. So essentially QE5 has started. They won't explicitly say this, but it is quantitative easing, where the Fed steps in and buys depressed assets at par value. It's a bit different than past QE, where they're guaranteeing par value. But that's essentially what happened.
Yeah. So one thing I would just add there, I think that the specifics are that they're not actually buying the assets, but they're taking them as collateral at par, and then giving the institutions the money, right? So like they're giving them par value, but it's like technically not a purchase, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the difference between QE, but effectively it's the same because the banks have access to money at par value for assets that clearly are not trading at par value, which is incredible. Like think about, again, like 10 years ago, I would have just been nonstop writing blog piece after blog piece, losing my head because it was so insane. But it's like people don't even blink an eye now. Whereas that would be the equivalent of, let's say, Whitney has her portfolio at Schwab. And, you know, 2 months ago, she bought all the high flying tech stocks and then they crashed 50%. And now, I am 50% less wealthy. And then the Fed comes in and says, oh, don't worry, Whitney, we're going to pretend that didn't happen. And we're going to just go back 2 months ago and to the value they were at. And we'll just lend you money based on that. And you're going to be fine, right? Wouldn't that be nice, right? I mean, it's effectively pausing reality for banks so that they can get money and be liquid. And so you can argue that, if you want, that that's important at this moment. But the bigger point is that how do you ever get out of stuff like this, right? I mean, once it's exactly what started in 2008. Once you go down a path like this, you cannot go back. I mean, you really can't. And the Fed was trying to prove that it could kind of go back to normal by raising rates. But look what happens. They raise rates a bunch, and now they're doing crazy stuff again, right away, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the taxpayer angle, though, is interesting because, you know, JP Morgan this morning is saying that the amount of liquidity that could flow into banks could be up to $2 trillion. And what the $2 trillion estimate is coming from, they basically took the assets of the bonds of maybe the treasury bonds, I'm not sure exactly which fixed income securities, of non too big to fail banks only, and said, how much do they hold on their balance sheets? And I think their number is $2 trillion. So JP Morgan's is effectively saying that $2 trillion could just be pumped into banks if they want to use this facility very quickly. So just think about that. I mean, to say that, I mean, yeah, the taxpayer is not only on the hook, like civilization is on the hook. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is so much bigger than the taxpayer. This is just another, I guess, salvo in like a coup, you know, effectively. It's just a coup.
I heard someone describe it as privatizing gains, but socializing losses.
Yes. It's certainly that. I mean, it's all a function. I mean, to put it most simply, there's too much debt and not enough dollars. And mm-hmm. when the Fed raises rates and pulls dollars out of the market, like the interest expenses on the debt that exists become impossible to pay. Like, it's just a function of how the Federal Reserve operates, like and how the fiat monetary system operates. We've created too much debt, and there are not enough dollars to service the interest on the debt, let alone the principal on the debt as well. And so, like, functionally, the Fed has to produce more dollars, print more dollars to begin trying to service the debt. And so, what's really interesting, when you go back to 2008, and then you fast forward to 2020, 2008. Fed steps in, prints a bunch of money, lowers rates, and then 2016, 2017 begins to reverse that policy. Then we get to 2020. You know, it was actually before 2020, in September of 2019. We had a repo market spasm, which was driven by Fed policy, trying to pull dollars out of the system. Something broke. And then coincidentally, in 2020, COVID happened, and they were able to lower rates, print a bunch of money. And then fast forward to today, just 3 years later, a year and a half after they started raising rates and pulling dollars out of the system, it's broke again. So I think what I'm trying to highlight here is just the compression of the time between Fed policy decisions and something breaking. It's accelerating at a rapid pace. And so right now, the Fed, like if we thought the amount of money that the Fed printed in 2020 was insane, the amount of money that they're going to have to print after this breakdown of the banking system is going to be unfathomable. They're going to have to print trillions and trillions of dollars, and that is just going to exacerbate inflation terribly. I mean, the Fed really didn't want to be put in a position right now to lower rates because inflation is still high. It's reported 6%.
Yeah, but BlackRock is saying that they think the Fed is going to keep tightening. And that's interesting because the BlackRock, and at the end of 2019, basically convinced the Fed to alter its monetary policy, the going direct reset or going direct policy. So I don't really know what that means, but maybe BlackRock has reason to believe, you know, reasons we don't know what they are exactly, you know, something they know that we don't know that leads them to expect that the Fed's going to keep tightening.
Well, one commentary I saw sort of after the bailout on Sunday, someone was saying that this could allow the Fed to keep raising rates while keeping banks operating, right? So like the banks don't have to necessarily face reality, but they'll, and therefore they could sort of keep functioning, but we could keep raising rates for everyone else and kind of keep messing with the economy. But my feeling, and that is an interesting theory. And I think if they do continue to raise rates, we need to take that more seriously. But I will, on a sort of personal level, if I was a betting man, I would say no, that they're pretty much done. And the reason I say that is because the drop in 2-year treasury rates. It's the fastest drop in the last, I think, this week since 1987. So the 2-year treasury yield has dropped 100 basis points or 1% in like 3 days, right? And what that signals and historically tends to always signal is that the market is saying there's no way you're raising rates, and in fact you're going to cut rates, and that's what people are betting, essentially hundreds of billions of dollars on that bet. And my conclusion would be that's probably correct, that the market is accurate on that.
The banking crisis is becoming abundantly clear. It's not isolated to the United States. It's spreading to Europe and affecting the global economy. I think I agree with Michael. They're going to have to lower rates.
Yeah. So you have what we talked about earlier. You have 6 other banks, I think, all based in the U.S. on downgrade watch, and then you have this stuff going on with Credit Suisse right now, which has led many to argue that the contagion here is spreading into Europe. But there's a couple interesting things to know about Credit Suisse. So, you know how we were talking about not that long ago, like Signature was being investigated, Silvergate was being investigated, and I think it was Silvergate that was having problems and was going to delay, among other things, the filing of their annual report. And Credit Suisse actually had a lot of those same problems. So, from March 2nd, there was a news headline: Credit Suisse breach spills personal info of high net worth clients all over the place. And then I think not long after that, Credit Suisse delays annual report after late call from the SEC. So there seems to be, and the subtext of that from CNN is Credit Suisse just can't catch a break, right? And this is before they had, their current. Those poor guys, yeah. So anyway, that's interesting, right? Because now Credit Suisse obviously having a lot of problems, and there's claims, now that like the Swiss central bank may have to step in and all this stuff to rescue it. And obviously there's some problems there, but it's just interesting that it seems like they were having problems before, and maybe if they think they couldn't weather that storm, they see an opportunity to sort of blame something else for their woes. Any thoughts on that?
I think Credit Suisse has been in a vulnerable position even before this week. I think they had a mass exodus of deposits last year, and they were already critically weak. And I think a lot of people on Wall Street were looking at Credit Suisse and just waiting for it to die. It seems like this banking crisis spreading from the U.S. to Europe is just going to be the final nail in the coffin for Credit Suisse. And I do believe that the Swiss National Bank stepped in overnight to provide a $54 billion loan to Credit Suisse. But it seems like as U.S. markets open today, that they're beginning to price the probability of a Credit Suisse failure. It's almost a certainty now with how their credit default swaps are trading.
Yeah. As Marty said, I mean, Credit Suisse has been dying for like decades, kind of like it's a long time.
So have a lot of other banks in Europe, right? So if Credit Suisse falls, what does that mean for other banks in deep shit like Deutsche Bank?
Right.
Santander and stuff.
Yeah. No, I think, here's the key thing. And why Credit Suisse is just a whole different can of worms from what we've been discussing, but also could lead into the same kind of path that we've seen with the CBDC. Because so Credit Suisse, I mean, what they would have to do there is it's unimaginable to my mind, how Credit Suisse is, and their assets and what they owe and the counterparties is linked to everything else. You know what I mean? It would be crazy cascades if something was, happened there. So of course the Swiss National Bank, I think, did, as Marty said, step in with $50 billion or something last night. To me, I want to go back to the big point, which is this system is obviously not sustainable for any long period of time, because every time you do these giant bailouts or liquidity injections, all you're doing is just kind of keeping it afloat without addressing any of the underlying issues. Like the balance sheet issues are not being solved. None of this stuff is being solved, but they're just keeping everything sort of floating up with liquidity. And what that does then is, which is what we've seen over the last 10 years, you just build up more, right? You build up more debt, you build up more of a bigger balance sheet, you end up with a bigger problem down the road. And my personal view is that the powers that be completely understand this. I mean, they know, this is why they're talking about a great reset, right? Because they know a reset is coming. And so what they're trying to do is they want to reset it themselves instead of allowing the public or even, you know, legislative bodies like Congress to have a role in resetting it. They want to essentially preempt that process and create their own reset in their minds. And then once the time is right, you know, just push it all in there. And so that's, you know, where I think this is going, you know, and I think that we need to really be open to the possibility of anything, because to actually attempt the reset in the way they want it, you do need a lot of fear and you need a lot of people being hurt. And so sort of like the panic that we saw over the weekend, but times 10. And that's what I think we're going to see in the next year.
All right. So one question I have regarding all of this. So if the crisis is systemic, which it seems that it is, and it seems that this is gearing up to be something on par, if not worse, than the 2008 financial crisis, what about bail-ins, right? So after 2008, you know, the Dodd-Frank thing comes out and it's like, oh, no bailouts, but it did allow bail-ins to happen, right? Or at least that legislation allows for bail-ins to happen. And bail-ins is supposed to bail out. So bailouts is taxpayer money bailing out the bank. But bail-ins is when banks use depositor money to sort themselves out, right? So what do you think is the likelihood of seeing some of that if things worsen?
I think it's pretty high. I would not be surprised at all. And we begin to see this in other parts of the world. I mean, Lebanon probably most notably in the last couple of years, they've done bail-ins where they got put, their central bank and their banking system got put in such a situation that they said, hey, anything over 200,000 Lebanese pounds, we're going to confiscate, and it's ours now. And the situation is not much different here in the United States or in Europe. So I think everything is on the table. They're going to print money, and I would certainly not be surprised if they do bail-ins on top of that as well.
Yeah, I think so that would be a huge thing. I think Cyprus had the bail-ins, right? They were mm-hmm. the only example I could kind of think of. And then Bitcoin actually rallied a ton right after that, I remember. If they do bail-ins, right, which again is where you depositors take a haircut on their accounts, which is the exact opposite of what just happened over the weekend, in my opinion, that would be part of the psyop, effectively, right? I mean, to have bail-ins would be such a scaremongering thing to people. Because, you know, in a tweet I wrote a couple of days ago, I said three things are needed to facilitate the rollout of CBDCs. And the first one I said is make holding money in banks feel completely unsafe. And so a bail-in would definitely do that. You know, it would make people understand that their money is not safe and it could be haircutted at any moment, and therefore clamor for a solution. And of course, you know, people like myself already have our solution, you know, in Bitcoin. But you know, your average person is gonna say, or even business would say, you know, oh, we need a solution quick. And there you go, you know, a CBDC could be that solution. Just hold your money, you know, in this CBDC. And it's safe. It's not, you know, it's not being loaned out. It's not being leveraged. It's just right here. It's for you at all times. And it's completely safe and guaranteed. And I think you need some sort of fear point like that. And maybe bail-ins is a trigger. I don't know. There could be a lot of triggers, but that's a potential one.
Yeah. And I think bail-ins actually interesting in the context of CBDCs could be like a normalization tactic, because with the CBDC, we're seeing it in China already. Like, it wouldn't necessarily be a bail-in, but it would be like a normalization of the money in your wallet has an expiration date, where you can have your CBDC wallet and the Fed will airdrop money into it. And they'll say, hey, you have 2 weeks to spend this, and you can only spend it on this, that, and the other goods on this list. Which is like an interesting nudging that could happen as well.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, they've been talking about this forever, which is like essentially forcing people to spend money, which is exactly what that would do. You know, they just airdrop you money that you have to spend in a month. I mean, it was just like rats in an experiment. It's just totally crazy.
So as we wrap up here, there was one thing I wanted to talk about too, regarding how all of this has been affecting stablecoins, specifically USDC and their issuer Circle. So there was a lot of concern about Circle because of I think they were one of the most exposed companies after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. And now, of course, you know, not necessarily so. And apparently they've decided to have reserves now at BNY Mellon, which is funny to me because they're a really dirty bank and pop up in my books a lot. So I don't know. When you look at how a lot of the other big stable coins, like Tether, for example, they have their banks at Deltek, the Bahamian bank that was super tied up with FTX and is like insanely shady themselves. It just kind of sticks out to me that a lot of these stable coins seem to have their reserves at some of the, I don't know, most suspect banks possible. But it also, you know, it seems like there's an effort to sort of clamp down to an extent on stable coins, or at least get them tied up with certain banks that are friendly to some of these unfortunate agendas that we've been discussing today. Do you guys have any thoughts about how all of this has been affecting stable coins and sort of the politics between stable coins and a likely CBDC launch?
I think, as Michael explained earlier in this discussion, like the US sees stable coins as somewhat of a systemic risk, but if you look at the other side of the coin, they could see it as an incredible opportunity as well, where they can co-opt Circle, consolidate them into banks that they fully control, and then somewhat take over Circle and control it fully control it. I think if I were to put my chips on the table and bet on who becomes the private entity in the public-private cooperation for a CBDC, I Circle would be high on that list. So I think what we're seeing now is sort of like a cornering of Circle into these systemically important banks. And at some point in the future, the government or the Federal Reserve could step in and say, hey, we're going to need you to create this CBDC pilot for us.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So to expand on that, I agree with everything you said. So if you think about it, and this goes back to my point earlier, which is that there is a decentralized sort of organic way you could reset, which is what I think there's a lot of. Bitcoin is a huge part of that, for example, right? I mean, that's exactly kind of what Bitcoin is here to do. And then there's the WEF and others who are taking it upon themselves to reset us into what they want. So there's like these two competing forces that are battling effectively right now. And so the stablecoin ecosystem, I'm starting to view as crucial in this battle, because thus far you've had, and I'm including, you know, sort of the network SEN and Signet in this as well, right? You have sort of a Wild West a little bit of a system that's developed over the last few years with around stablecoins and around these 24/7 networks, right? That facilitate the cryptocurrency ecosystem, and that's more or less been you could put it into this sort of decentralized organic resetting of things. But I think now the USG and the Fed see that as having gone too far, let's say, right? Like this is too organic, right? This is too kind of out of our control. And so I think Marty made a really good point in that this could be, right now we could be seeing the very beginning stages of the government and the Fed starting to sort of co-opt these. And they may have already been, you know, like Circle, I agree. I mean, Circle has always kind of been like, it's kind of like red flaggy to me, always, right? But like even more so. And so this goes back to what we discussed earlier, which is that there could be this transition point where a C, you know, a, you get a C, certain CBDC. I'm sorry, a certain stablecoin. Let's say it's USDC. That would be the top contender in my view as well. That becomes sort of state sanctioned in a way, right? And so Circle maybe all of a sudden in 6 months is all at JP Morgan, right? And JP Morgan is doing Circle and this USDC, and it's all integrated like that. And then they can just allow it to run that way for a while. And it could sort of effectively be like a proto CBDC that's kind of ostensibly run privately. But then in a future crisis, right, they could create a crisis with that and say, okay, no, now we need to take it fully under our own control, right? And that's one, I think, pathway for this to happen.
Oh, man. Well, one thing that comes to mind based on what you just said, you know how we were talking about, or I mentioned earlier, you know, why they were targeting Silvergate after FTX, but not Farmington State Bank, right, or Moonstone, as it was renamed to be. They had just partnered with a company that's very interesting. And one of the main guys on it is the guy that claimed to invent CBDCs. was, you know, and that was helping lead, you know, this particular tiny bank in the middle of nowhere in Washington State that had all this cash come in from Alameda Research. They were leading some of their digital transformation and, you know, financial services stuff. So, you know, maybe that's what saved them, some of their ties to CBDC architects or something like that. It honestly would not surprise me at this point. All right. Well, anything else you guys would like to add in before we wrap up here? I definitely want to let people listening know, you know, what they can tangibly expect in the coming weeks and months, and, you know, maybe some solutions for people that are worried about having their money in banks and things like that.
Well, I mean, I think Michael and I would both agree that times are dire. The Fed and the U.S. government are on their heels, and they're going to try to cattle herd citizens into the CBDC future where they have full control. Yeah. This is why I focus all my energy and time on Bitcoin, because I view the future as pretty binary. We either get the dystopian hellscape of CBDCs, or we get a truly grassroots emergent monetary system built on Bitcoin. So anybody listening who is thinking of how to protect themselves against the CBDC future, I would highly recommend that you begin educating yourself about Bitcoin. And once you're sufficiently educated and confident that you believe Bitcoin makes sense and is something worthwhile, acquire Bitcoin. But most importantly, don't only get Bitcoin, do not hold it on an exchange. Bitcoin has native properties that allow you to control it in a wallet that only you can access, and no government or company can stop you from accessing it. So it's, if you're getting into Bitcoin, it's not only important that you buy it, but that you actually possess it as well. You do not want to hold your Bitcoin on exchanges, because that will be a pressure point that the government will use. I believe in the future, they will shut down these on and off ramps. So it is very crucial, while we have the time to do so, that people acquire Bitcoin and get it into wallets that they control. Because at some point in the future, the government or the Federal Reserve can flip a switch and make it very hard to get Bitcoin.
Yeah. From my point of view, I think that, you know, as Marty said, right, it's a binary, and I think that's right. So, you know, you have to understand, I think everyone needs to understand that, you know, if we're going to have a more decentralized, let's say, networked world with more freedom versus the, you know, very rigidly hierarchical, centralized, you know, sort of panopticon world, which the WEF wants, and many in the United States want as well, intelligence agencies in particular, let's say, you know, there's a responsibility that comes with the former, right? The networked decentralized world with freedom. There's a lot of responsibility that comes along with that. And I think that's one of the key things that Marty was saying about Bitcoin. I mean, there's to do Bitcoin properly, you know, you really, there's a degree of responsibility you need to take and be willing to take that. And so people need to also be responsible for their emotions. And this is like the primary trigger. Like if we go the wrong way, I firmly believe that it's because too many people were not responsible for their own emotions and are allowing fear
and just programming to get the better of them, which allows these things to push forward. And, you know, so be ready, because that is what's going to be triggered, your fear response, you know, your just natural reaction. And of course, like the media, you know, like these mainstream media, like, seriously, there should be a warning on every single like broadcast at CNN, because it is so poisonous to your mind. It is such programming. I think the best advice I could give is, when some new thing happens that's big and scary, you know, try to just chill out for a second, you know, take a step back, you know, don't just react. Because I think particularly, you know, people like us too, that we have social media presences that are reasonably large, you feel the need to kind of have a conclusion or have a response or have a reaction kind of quickly. And I've found, at least personally, that the best path is to not do that, because let it settle out a little bit. Like see what's, how does the system react? You know, how's the public reacting? Why are we being triggered in this way? And so that would be my advice, would just be really guard your mind, really guard your emotions, because that is what's being very intentionally triggered with every PSYOP to bring us to that state we all don't want to be.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I've talked to some people from Argentina, because, you know, I live in Chile, and, you know, they had a full-blown economic collapse, you know, about 20 years ago. And what I heard from them, you know, is that the best thing you can do in that kind of situation is not give in to the panic and the fear, because that's going to lead you to make impulsive decisions you may otherwise have not made. And you're definitely going to be better off if you can keep your cool when things get insane in the economy. And, you know, it's not just going to be Argentina this time, or just going to be like a certain sector of the U.S. economy. Like, all the stuff is woven together. So, you know, if too much stuff starts to go, you know, we can definitely see what'll happen. But I also want to give advice to some people who aren't necessarily, you know, in crypto or interested in crypto, because not all of my audience is. So what would you guys say to people who, you know, have accounts at some of the big banks like JP Morgan, Wells Fargo, et cetera? You know, is their money safe there? Should they think about putting it elsewhere? And if so, where?
I mean, all the big banks are insolvent. they're insolvent, essentially. Their only way they're going to survive moving forward is the Fed printing money or launching a CBDC. Like, the banking system, the way it's erected with fractional reserve banking and money printing at the Federal Reserve, is doomed for failure. I mean, personally, I would only keep as much money in the bank as you're willing to lose. I truly believe, and I know it's a touchy topic and people get very emotional about it, and that's why I urge people to educate themselves about it. I'm not going to tell anybody to just go buy Bitcoin right now, like ape into it. Educate yourself about it. If you spend the time to learn about it, I think that you'll come to the logical conclusion that it makes a lot more sense than the incumbent banking system. Me personally, I hold most of my savings in Bitcoin and not in the banking system. That's what I recommend in terms of like an alternative to the big banks. I really don't think there are many. They're systemically important. They're the only ones that will get bailed out every time a crisis arises. Maybe a small community bank, but as we're seeing with this regional banking crisis playing out right now, maybe they're not even safe. It is really weird times in the market for money, because the Federal Reserve has completely destroyed the dollar and any confidence we can have in it moving forward.
Yeah, so from my perspective, yeah, you're kind of asking two guys that probably haven't had big significant bank accounts for years. You know, after 2008-09, I mean, I haven't touched a too big to fail personally, you know, since, you know, and I've had whatever money I need in the bank effectively is just what I, you know, I'll put money in there to pay bills, you know, as I need to do that, or what I need for other things. But yeah, I've just been, you know, I try to stay away from the banking system for over a decade. So, you know, I'm not the best guy to ask about like how to navigate the banking system, because I try to stay away from it. But if I'm not going to talk about like, you know, Bitcoin or even some precious metals,
What I would suggest then, what I would do, like if someone said to me, you know, gun to your head, you can't buy Bitcoin, you can't buy any precious metals, you know, those are not your options. So what are you going to do? You got a bunch of money in the banks. What I would probably do is I would look around and I would say, okay, how do I make my life more resilient? You know, like what is it going to take? You know, do I start to grow a garden? Do I add this to my landscape? Do I get chickens like we did? Do I stock up on stuff?
Yeah, your money in real stuff keep you alive. That's usually what I tell people.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So for example, let me give you one example, and I haven't done this because for a variety of reasons, although it's always in the back of my mind. Okay, so clearly there's going to be some serious tensions between the U.S. and China. You know, and if you think it's bad now, you haven't seen anything. And probably at some point, and I don't know what that point will be, it could be in 2027, I have no idea, but at some point, you know, the products that are made in China are just going to somehow not find their way here anymore, you know, and that's a lot of stuff. So what sort of, what sort of things, do you need? You know, what sort of things will be important to your resilience, over the coming years? There's of course food is an important one. Energy is another one. Having your shelter, you're sort of secured. I mean, do you need certain batteries? Do you need, things like that? So if you're not wanting to like put your money into alternative, let's say financial assets, I would definitely be investing in having things that you're going to use anyway, right? Like don't stockpile stuff that you're not going to use. But if you know that you're going to use this, this, and that over the next 3 years, why not just have it now? You know, if you've got the money to burn in the bank and you're scared of that. You know, the other thing that, this is what my wife and I have been, we've been totally dedicating 2023 so far to this. And it's been going really well. It's been busy, but, skills, right? Learning skills that you don't have, that you think would be helpful. And so I would encourage everyone out there to think about that. Like where do you feel like you're lacking? So for me personally, there've been a few areas. One of them is just my inability really to DIY and make things in the physical world at all. You know, I grew up in New York City where like nobody knows how to do anything. You just call the freaking superintendent, right? To like come fix everything. So for me, I felt very vulnerable in that regard. So, I'm taking a woodworking class, for example, in like carpentry, trying to learn how to do that stuff. And it's a massive learning curve. Like it reminds me of Bitcoin too. Like it's just, you're just like drinking from a fire hose.
No, but it's necessary stuff.
Yeah. Yeah,
because
exactly.
Even like before these crises, no one, people in the U.S. were just completely losing on a generational level, right, the ability to produce any of their own stuff. Like the knowledge base is going away, and that has to come back for the U.S. to have any sort of self-sufficiency going forward, right?
Yeah. So we like our kids were also, we're very focused on that kind of stuff. Like our oldest son is doing woodworking classes too. So it's up to us, don't just be this, again, I think. For a while, I did this too. I just buy Bitcoin. I'd sit around and be like, okay, well, when's the world going to kind of blow up, right? But really, every single moment, don't waste your time, I guess is my point. Like there is every single one of us has a gap, right? Like, and we probably know what it is. And you're just like, I wish I was better at this, right? Or I wish I kind of, well, just go get better at it, right? Go learn it.
Yeah. You don't want to be caught totally unprepared with what's coming because I think it's pretty clear that, if this gets ultra, super, mega crazy and people are just left penniless, the Fed's going to write and be like, oh, well, here's your subsidy or whatever, or here's some money, from the government to keep you alive, but it's only in CBDC form and it's programmable money. So you can only use it on the things we say you can use it on. And bam,
totally.
It's over.
Exactly. And like even making, local connections. We started buying goat cheese, raw goat cheese from a neighbor, I could walk to, in the last 2 months. It's been great. It's been one. It's the best cheese I've ever had in my life. Like little things like that. Just, there are things everybody can do in that regard.
Yeah. No, that's something that's been, there's been a big movement within Bitcoin, like with this in mind, which is the concept of going out and shaking your rancher's hand. Maybe you can't ranch, maybe you can't farm. But what you can do is get in your car and drive to your local ranch, your local farm, shake that farmer's hand and figure out how you can support them. So if you're not going to be able, you don't think you're going to be able to be self-sufficient in building a farm or a ranch to supply your own food, there are people around you that are, and they need to be supported. Just building community and connections locally is extremely important in times like these.
Yep, totally agree.
All right, well, sounds like we're all pretty much on the same page there. And obviously, we'll be seeing how the situation plays out over the next few weeks and months. These issues obviously are not going to go away. So with that being said, so people that are interested listening to this podcast, how can they follow you guys, whether on social media or elsewhere?
Yeah, if you want to follow me, I usually hang out on Twitter, at Marty Bent. And I have a website, tftc.io. You can find my newsletter there where I write about Bitcoin and freedom in the digital age. And then the podcast as well, TFTC and Rabbit Hole Recap.
Yeah, from my end, I'm mostly publicly facing on Twitter at Liberty Blitz, BLITZ, Liberty Blitz. Yeah, I have my website, Liberty Blitzkrieg, though, if I don't really write on it anymore, but there's a ton of stuff there. I mean, if you want to just search any word you think is interesting, I mean, you're going to find a lot of articles I wrote almost daily for nearly a decade. So I'm sure I'll write again at some point in my life, but just not at the moment. So yeah, I'm pretty much public facing on Twitter, and that's effectively it.
Okay, well, super. Well, thanks so much, guys, for coming back on to talk about even more financial craziness. I'm sure I'll have you guys back probably sooner rather than later, depending on how all of this plays out. Thanks so much to everyone for listening, especially people who support this podcast. A big thanks to you all for keeping this going. And yeah, we'll catch you on the next episode. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Whitney.